Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
We'll be right back. on the bass guitar. Birds brighter. And on the drums, yeah, from the Linda. Jan Akkerman. Een organ, een vleugel, Thijs van
Focus, Hocus Pocus, off Live at the Rainbow, 1973.
It should be called Bonkers Conkers. That's what it is. I'm used to it now, but my goodness, that's like Spaghetti Head, psychedelic trip city.
Well, I remember the first time I played you this, we were driving at night in the van of rock down to London.
Oh.
And I put it on, and you couldn't speak to me, if
no,
I remember.
I didn't know how to process it. I had no idea. I'd never heard anything like it before in my life. I think the only time I'd heard yodeling was in The Sound of Music.
Well,
what's going on?
Well, it's a remarkable track, and you know, the whole band were fantastic. But those two, I mean, Jan Akkerman and Theus van der Linden. Theus van Leer, I should say. Theus van Leer, he, you know, but it was the whole band, you know. I think that album, a live album, they really captured Focus at their best. People have disagreed with me on this, but I love his guitar playing. I think the whole performance is really good and tight and it had a lot of energy, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a lot faster, the live version, than the studio version.
It is.
But it's just... It's incredibly creative, and guess who produced that album?
Well, I know exactly who produced it. It's Mike Vernon again.
He comes out the closet. Hello, yeah, did that one too. Bang.
And he produced Moving Waves, which was the studio album, and he produced his live album as well, which is cool, you know.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you get producers though or engineers that actually do like one, and it doesn't sort of work like. But I think he's really captured it there, and Jan Akkerman. And I've said it before, but he's the unsung hero of guitar players, really. I think he's probably the best out of all of them from the 60s and early 70s. He's so inventive. It's sort of jazz rock, but it's sort of he has a real musicality about it. It's not doesn't sound overly jazzy, if you know what I mean, even though it is, and he's playing some fiendishly, fearsomely difficult parts there,
yeah.
But it just seems to work. And I think he's using an old Fender PA amp that he linked all the channels together. I saw him on the old Grimmsel set, and I thought, what the hell's that? What's he doing with that? And he gets this great racket out of it, you know. But you know, the whistling and the flute and the yodeling, and it's just unbelievable.
I tell you what, I didn't realise this, that Melody Maker named Jan Akkerman the world's best guitarist in 1973 ahead of Clapton.
Is that right? Well, there we are. I didn't know that. So it just goes to say, prove my point at that time.
Exactly, at that time. Mm. And that's something. And you know, when we watched the old Grey Whistle Test, that really has endeared me to them because they were giggling like kids.
We
always laugh. We always giggle with them. But what I didn't realise was that after that show, Bob Harris was inundated with phone calls. And for the next 10 days, Polydor's record pressing plant were just doing focus albums.
Mm.
Completely just reignited people's interest in the band. And that's from the live thing, and that's what I really like. And I think what endeared them to me was the way they were just, as you say, giggling. So yeah. I love them. I love them so much.
Well, that, with the old wrestling test, that was with John Otway and Wild Willie Barrett. And he jumped on his amp and he broke it and knocked it over. And that's what turned it, you know. He turned their careers, and really free, it went right to the top of the charts and all that, you know. It just shows the power of television. Certainly them, and the power of the old Grey Whistle Test, because it really focused on albums, didn't it?
It was, yeah.
It was all about selling albums and promoting albums, which is a great thing.
Yeah, and I think that's part of that listening experience. So instead of like curated playlists now, an artist really could give you an hour of their own creation, curated creation.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. Mm. And a lot of people tell us, you know, digital people, you know, deal with Spotify all the time. Oh, you should be doing singles, and you know, you get as much marketing out of a single as you do out of an album, but as a piece of work, as an artist, I think an album is still a valid format, you know. It's like a photographer taking a series and doing an exhibition. You know, you just don't put one photograph up, you'll put 30 up. And a piece of art, you know, they're doing an exhibition. They don't put one piece of art up 1 week and then they take that down and put another piece up. What they do is that they have them all lined up on the wall because they're all generally connected and have some type of artistic merit and
it's an experience.
That's right, experience, yeah. In the same way. Mm, yeah,
indeed.
Pioneer, we've got to have some music on the new frontier. your passion, your secret fear. Prepare to meet the challenge of the new frontier.
New Frontier by Donald Fagen from The Nightfly in 1982.
Well, there's a few things about that track. The first is the Fender Rhodes all the way through it, Donald Fagen, with that beautiful tremolo. And at the end, you can hear it. If you put headphones on, you can hear it wobbling around in your ears. It makes you a bit seasick. Beautiful sound. The next thing is, as soon as it comes on, that track, or anything from this album, the production, it jumps out and hits you around the face like a big fish. Slap, 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 slap. It's so beautiful. Everything is in the right place. And when we played Linton Festival a few weeks ago, the sound engineer actually was checking his system when we got there in the morning before we did sound check to this very track. And I've got to say, every time that we ever did any recording sessions at Supertone Studios, when we do, I always play this track, and I always play Bob Dylan, Oh Mercy, by Daniel Lanois produced it, before I start anything, because that is my reference points, and I listen to them and think, right, these are great productions, completely different, but great. And that's it. What else can you say?
It was funny, actually, you know, because as soon as I heard this track at Linton, I'm like, I trust the sound guy. It was really, it was one of those things. It's like, yeah, like you're on the same page, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's just something about this album. So Larry Carlton was on lead guitar.
He certainly was. And I was about to mention that, of course.
Well,
I thought
make a change, actually. I'll do a guitar bit.
Excellent. Well done. And also, did you know, with his 335 on this, he was using a Gibson 335, he's Mr. 335 that he's known as, but he was using a Fender Tweed Deluxe amp on this. So all those Dumble fanatics out there, say, oh, here he's Dumbles and all this sort of carry on. Well, he'd know. This is using a Tweed Deluxe, a 50s Tweed Deluxe, like we've got, which recorded most of Blue Reply with, and it just sounds fantastic. Little 10-watt amp, on pretty low there, I suspect, but what a beautiful sound. And his playing is so sensitive. He's just so beautiful, you know. He's a jazz player, but again, it doesn't sound like jazz. It's got that just richness and beautiful harmonies and melodies. Gorgeous.
What I like about this album as well is this is Donald's first album that he released after Steely Dan. So this is his first solo album. Mm-hmm. And so there's like a... He's been, I think he was very careful about it. I think he used about 31 session musicians in total. We know the recount the stories of just getting session guys in all the time and then not knowing who was going to make the cut, wasn't it?
Everybody. It was like it was like who was going to, you know, it was like the knives out.
It was like the music speed date, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Give us a kiss and see what you feel like.
Well, I'm not quite sure it was on this album. I just remembered something about Larry Carlton, right? Yeah. And there was a session, and I was speaking to this engineer that was at the session. I can't remember. It's a long time ago now. And he was, I think he was assistant engineer. And Larry Carlton walked in into the studio, plugged his guitar in. They did a playback of the track. And then he started packing his gear up. And the engineer said, we haven't actually started recording yet. And he came into the studio and he said, listen, I play, you record. And that was it. And Larry Carlton's a nice guy, but he was obviously really pissed off, yeah. Which I think is very funny.
Yeah, yeah. God, I mean, we always record everything, don't we? Yeah. Maybe it's from that story.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing. You've got to hit record at all time. And now the thing, because we do record to digital, which... Even though it doesn't sound quite as good as tape, it is great. But you know, you haven't got any restriction over the amount of tape, and it never runs out in a session. Because the old 2-inch tape, you know, if the musician, if it, a big jam was going on for too long, and you could see the end of the tape coming up, you're thinking, oh no, ah.
We'll be right back. Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone. An actor out alone. Riders on the storm.
You're listening to The Rain on the Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that, of course, was The Doors and Riders on the Storm.
So atmospheric.
Marvellous. I saw on YouTube pretty recently Ray Manzarek, the keyboard player, of course, and he was showing how he wrote it originally. And he was actually on his Fender Rhodes. Of course, the Fender Rhodes making another appearance after the earlier track, you know, from New Frontier stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it was marvellous how he actually described how he wrote it and actually how he came up with that line, you know, which is one of those most iconic keyboard solos and riffs or whatever it is, parts, I suppose, of all time, really. Because you know exactly what it is. Like that doodle-doodle-doodle-doo, you know.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It's kind of... It kind of gets you in a trance, doesn't it?
Mm.
I mean, the whole Jim Morrison thing, I mean, partly my knowledge of him has come from watching those films, you know, and they're not accurate. I mean, they are to an extent, and you see some documentaries of the footage of him. So you get a sense of who he is. And, you know, I knew that he, Jim and Manzarek had both went to UCLA School of Theatre, Film and Television. So they met there, and then they played at the London Fog, and they were then honing their skills, and it wasn't really... the Whiskey A Go-Go apparently was a lot better attended and a bigger gig, but they went to London Fog and basically got their act together and were improvising really long songs. So a few months after doing that, they were then became the house band at Whiskey A Go-Go, and they were like opening for Van Morrison's Them. So it's just interesting how all that, how they met and how they started to write together and create that sound. But they don't have a bass player.
No, they don't.
Now, what is that about? Because you can only have a certain type of bass sound and a bass style with that song.
Well,
with that band.
But you see, the thing is that there's, you know, the Jimmy Smith thing with the Hammond organ, that left-hand bass and the foot pedals and stuff. When you've got keyboards, it is really quite... You know, it's almost pretty standard because John Paul Jones did it in Led Zeppelin on No Quarters. Quite a few parts of that was, you know, most of the Zeppelin albums have piano bass on at one stage because they had that Fender Rhodes piano bass as well. He plays with his left hand, and Manzarek used one as well, I know.
Yeah.
And it's quite a normal thing, but you're right. But I think, doesn't that just give it a different atmosphere? Because,
yeah.
You know, I mean, Johnny Henderson, our keyboard player, who plays with Matt Schofield as well, and Matt Schofield goes out as a trio with a drummer and Johnny and himself, and he plays, you know, the bass as well, which is cool.
I remember when I first played with Johnny, I was having a go, I was winding him up going, oi, like, step away from the bass pedals. That's my job.
It was very funny, yeah. And I suppose we better announce it, really, because we're delighted to be, have been allowed the opportunity to headline at the Wangaratta Jazz and Blues Festival in Australia in November, which is incredible, on a Saturday night.
So exciting.
And it just happens that Matt Schofield is headlining the Friday night.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely fantastic. It's a British invasion, you know. And what I didn't know until yesterday is that we were both born in Ratcliff in Manchester. And I couldn't believe it. So Matt Schofield and I were both born in Ratcliff. A long time apart, but nevertheless.
I know what you're saying. So it's like, so you've got all this. This is the other thing that's I was thinking about with the Doors when I was thinking about the bass line. It got me thinking about Johnny. Then I was thinking about how they were in the middle of the counterculture, right in the centre, yeah. Bang, smack.
Right in the thick of it, weren't they?
They were, weren't they? And then what I found out as well, so they first signed to Elektra as well. I just wanted to talk a little bit more about this, then we'll move on to the next track. They got signed to Elektra, then 3 days after they signed, they got sacked from the Whiskey A Go-Go because Morrison was off his head and did this whole version of, it was the Greek myth of Oedipus during the end, and he was like, it was an explicit retelling and it was full of profanity and he got sacked.
Well, but I mean, his stage show as well, he was actually, you know, I mean, he was renowned, wasn't he, you know, for his sexual acts on stage, you know, and it was and for that time it was completely outrageous, but really he was a poet. That was his thing, wasn't he, Jim Morrison?
Yeah, and I get that, and I know that they've sold over like 100 million records worldwide and they're just huge. And they do say though that it was that combination, Jim's basically the Doors. I mean, yes, he's Manzarek, but you know, in terms of his charismatic,
yeah, Robbie Krieger as well. I mean, the whole band, it's like those things, it was a band thing, and they created that sound as a band,
yeah,
you know,
because it wasn't the same once Jim had died.
No, of course, it couldn't be, but of course, that album. That track was produced by Bruce Botnick, and we're going to hear a bit of that Bruce later on.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed could look at me and know I dream of you. Knowing I say this time it's goodbye, dear. Loving you the way I do, I take you back. Without you, I die, dear. Knowing
Anyone Who Had a Heart by the gorgeous Cilla Black.
Yeah.
1964.
bit of a screechy voice, hasn't she? Really, really, because I'm not exactly sure who chose the mic for that, but I don't think the mic was the right thing. She might just have a... Of course, there wasn't that EQ, but it was a very penetrating note. But it did really well, that song, didn't it?
Well, it was. It's what a crazy whole story. When I looked into this song, like, I knew that Cilla had worked in the cavern. She was discovered. She was mates with the Beatles.
That's right, yeah. So she was the cloakroom attendant, wasn't she?
That's right, yeah. So she was championed by the Beatles. And that song, by the way, was written by Burt Bacharach and Hal David, who did the lyrics. And this is where it all gets slightly complicated. It was originally written for Dionne Warwick.
Yeah.
So Dionne Warwick recorded her version of it, and that was released in November 1963.
Okay.
And then in the January, so a couple of months later, it just hit the ground running. Dionne Warwick had top 10 hits in America, Canada, Spain, Netherlands, South Africa, Belgium and Australia.
Blimey.
But when it came to the UK, Cilla got in there first.
No!
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, I didn't know this, but the thing is, and this is the bit that I've got notes and I've put red so you can't read this bit because I don't want you to spoil the surprise. Okay, so here you go. 8th of February. Oh, yeah, so let's go back one. So George Martin had a scout that told him about this song that was doing really well for Dionne Warwick.
Right.
So anyway... So they thought they might give it to Shirley Bassey, but George Martin, who thought it'd be perfect for Cilla. So they recorded the song in Abbey Road. And so on the 8th of February, 1964, it got to number 28 in the UK charts. So it was 28 in the charts, mm-hmm. But the following week, Dionne Warwick released her version of the song. But by then, Cilla had already gone to 28. So Dionne came in at like 46.
Wow.
And basically didn't do anything because Cilla had won the minds and the radio play by then, I think. So Cilla went up the charts to 10, number 2, and actually hit the top spot. And Dionne lasted a couple of weeks and dropped off the charts. So basically her version of it. So Cilla Black won the UK, the Republic of Ireland and New Zealand as well from Dionne. So apparently Cilla said that Dionne Warwick was dead choked and she's never forgiven her.
I can imagine. I can only imagine the fury there. Wow.
But it gets even worse because Burt Bacharach, who wrote the song, actually championed Cilla to sing it as well.
No.
Yes. Because he cited as saying that at that time, the people from Liverpool artists were taking over the world.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And he said that Liverpool artist, the UK, the British artist, got him straight away.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, I'm talking about a vocal being a bit screechy, which it is, but the arrangement is beautiful. And the song is absolutely fantastic, you know. And these are all the songs and stuff that we listen to at home. That's what this show's all about. So we have this vinyl and we put them on and we just stick random stuff on and by listening to it. And this is what you got on the show, isn't it? You know, and we just do what we listen to. So, you know, and they're all connected, though, because the Beatles and George Martin, of course, and then Cilla and that whole thing and Jeff Emmerich. I don't know who actually engineered this, but I'll have to find out. Great story, though.
It was arranged by Johnny Pearson. I've got another surprise for you as well on this one.
Go on.
Okay, so guess who was in on the session? The Breakaways vocal group, Vic Flick. And on session guitar as well, Big Jim Sullivan.
Oh, my mentor. Goodness me. I can't believe he's dead, you know. He taught me everything about playing guitar, even though I only worked for him for a few months, you know. It was a remarkable experience.
It's quality, not quantity,
exactly. And it turned me around.
Dandelions can.
DJ from David Bowie's 13th studio album, Lodger, released on May the 18th, 1979, and the last of the Berlin Trilogy.
Duh.
Well.
Wow.
That was, and produced by Tony Visconti, who was with David Bowie's career on and off all the way through. And the last two albums, of course, he did, were absolutely magnificent with him. We've just got the Tony Visconti book. We're reading massive amounts of books
with
engineers and producers. It's amazing. I'm really looking forward to getting into this one. But, yeah, anyway, back to DJ.
It was released as a single as well. I don't even know what... I don't want to say any detail about this at the moment. I don't know the album that well, you see, so I was just
nobody does, because it was absolutely slated. I remember when it came out, and everybody was, oh, he's dead, Bowie's gone, it's all history, you know? And then, you know, later on, it was critically acclaimed, as with a lot of records, you know.
That, you know what, that started to really piss me off.
Yeah.
And because it's like retrospect all the time. Why can't people just move somewhere with you at the time and just try and just open up a bit instead of going, well, you sounded like that on your first album and your second, yeah, and maybe, you know, I know what I want, and I get a tin of beans, it says it's beans inside. Well, how about, you know, spicing it up a bit?
Yeah. Well, anyway, the same thing happened with Radiohead, you know, when Kid A came out, because when that came out after OK Computer, it was just a complete, I can't say it was a mind something, but it just turned the whole thing on its head, and all the Radiohead fans thought, what the hell's happening here?
Yeah,
it all changed. And I think Bowie, you know, after, you know, Heroes and all those, you know, which were recorded at Hansa Studios, this one was recorded at Mountain Studios. And I know a little bit about this, because John Mayer of Mayer Sound, he actually designed the studio monitors that were in this studio.
Really?
Yeah, and I met John Mayer. He's a very alternative guy. Let's put it that way. San Francisco, and I went there in the late 80s and met him. And he's a super cool guy, but very, very alternative. You know, wearing the factory. He was really interested in time. But yeah, he designed the studio monitors that are in there. The Mayer Sound things.
Mayer Sound.
Mm. The first of the real great PAs, I think. Really great. You know, now there's lots from D&B and stuff, but. Anyway, but back to Lodger and David Bowie.
So I'd never really knew about this Brian Eno and his oblique strategies cards. Tell me about that then.
Well, we post them on our Twitter feed quite regularly, because Brian Eno keeps putting them up and we repost them. And it was a way of developing lateral thinking in the Hansa Studios days. And I think the tracks, whether even why it was called the Berlin Trilogy, even though it was recorded somewhere else, they were written in Berlin at the time, because he was living with Iggy Pop, wasn't he, at the time?
Yeah.
In some flat or other in Berlin. Very interesting stories, and we can wax lyrical about it all night, but the oblique strategies thing, and they're great, because what they do, you read them and you think, what the hell's all that bit? But it makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Each of those cards make you think, oh, right, okay, yeah. And
it gets you out of a pattern. It gets you out of a familiar, churning out the same things by putting yourself in a different context or getting your head to think in a different way. It's a bit like when I write songs. If I write on guitar, I have certain chords that I'll go to, whereas if I write on the piano, everything changes. And I think that's what Brian Eno wants to do, like getting you to play an unfamiliar instrument and improvise on that, or play songs backwards, or just something different.
Because Adrian Belew was playing guitar on this, wasn't he?
Yes.
Of Frank Zappa. He nicked him out of Frank Zappa's band, which is what a training ground.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Adrian Belew was playing guitar on this rather than Robert Fripp. And sometimes he'd get him to play solos without even listening to the track or telling him what key it was in, which is just
that
crazy.
Must be weird.
Yeah, and amazing. But I love Adrian Belew's work. I think he's a great, you know, he's a great guitar player. He's very much a sonic sculptor, rather like Robert Fripp with the Frippatronics and all that sort of thing. But Belew is a different taste, because Robert Fripp is a very British thing, the King Crimson thing. And then, you know, Belew came from America, and it was a different, you know, a different vibe, really.
Great googly moogly.
Thank you. times I've waited patiently for you. And you'll do just what you choose to do. And I will be alone again tonight, my dear. Yeah, I've heard a funny thing somebody said to me. You know that I could be in love with almost everyone. I think that people are the greatest fun. And I will be alone again tonight, my dear.
Alone Again, or from the third studio album Forever Changes by American rock group called Love.
Released in 1967.
Yep.
What I'm going to talk about now is the pre-delay on the echo. There's a beautiful bit of production in there which you just didn't hear. And what happens if you listen to it very, very carefully in the middle, there's a delay between there's a vocal part and then there's a little bit of a delay and then the echo comes afterwards. And they've obviously... they've actually bumped it on the tape a little bit and put a little bit of pre-delay on the tape because they didn't have any machines to do it in those days. Absolutely beautiful. The other thing I've got to say about this track is that when we were in France, I heard it. It was on, I think it was on the radio or something, and I thought, oh, that's a great track, and I'd forgotten who it was by. And I went through every Moody Blues album, right, listening to each track, and I couldn't find it because it wasn't the Moody Blues, because it's those double vocals and the melodies. It could just be the Moody Blues to me. So that you remember. And the other interesting thing, of course, is that this was produced by Bruce Botnick, who also produced The Doors.
Yeah, because they actually had the same label, didn't they?
That's right, with Arthur Lee, of course, who was in the band, the main singer.
And he'd just come off working with Buffalo Springfield, and apparently Neil Young was on the cast to co-produce his album.
No.
But he pulled away because he wanted to focus on his solo career more than being working with bands. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that.
That's quite interesting. It was a bit sad, really, when you look at it. And here we go again. But it's the nature of the beast in terms of bands, you know, substance abuse, both Lee and Brian wanting to get their songs, you know, on the album, and Lee didn't want a tour to promote the album. And I think Botnick, at the end, what he did is they did two tracks in the studio, and then to really wind up the rhythm section, he got members of the Wrecking Crew in, including Carole Kaye, to record two songs in 3 hours.
Is that right? Blaine was on that album. That's
yeah.
Right. Hal Blaine was on as well, wasn't
yeah.
he? The famous drummer, yeah.
And what happened was that he kicked their ass, basically, because it made them think, okay, if you don't get your act together and get the rest of the album recorded, you're going to be replaced, Sunshine.
Well, it's probably cheaper to get the Wrecking Crew in than actually spend more studio time there, yeah.
Well, they finished the rest of the album in 64 hours.
Absolutely incredible. Well, there you go. But it's the end of the show, I'm afraid. And if you want to contact us, we're on Instagram, Starlight Campbell, Twitter, at Susie and Simon, and Facebook, of course.
And the show's available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes, and iHeartRadio. So please tell your friends. But we are going to play you out with a brilliant track today. We've been wanting to put this in the show for a few weeks now. It's a track by the White Stripes called Little Room from their third studio album, White Blood Cells, which was released in 2001.
You've got to love Jack White because he's committed. He's committed to actually capturing the sound of his live act. And, you know, to the detriment of the technical, you know, there's no messing about. He just actually turns the record on and that's it. He's doing a lot of it to tape. I believe recently he's gone to digital, but he uses a lot of it to tape. And, you know, it does have tremendous energy. And I think this song is one of my favourites because it's so short and it just kicks you in the ass. You know, it goes, you think, holy shit, you know. And the drumming is so frantic. And his vocal is so frantic, and the song is so good, you know, because he's a great songwriter, there's no doubt about it.
He's kick-ass.
He certainly is.
Do you remember when we saw him on the documentary, was it It Might Get Loud?
Great, yeah, great documentary.
Well, I was wondering whether or not this song is about the little room that he used to live in. Because, you know, he had a sketch, didn't he? And he had everything in this tiny room in his folks' house.
That's right, yeah.
So it, just wondering.
Quite possible. But, I mean, that whole documentary is fantastic with Jimmy Page and The Edge. And it always makes me laugh because, you know, Jack White, he's a good guitar player in a way, but he's so raw and so, unorganized, and Jimmy Page is there, Jimmy Page is showing him how to play Cashmere, and he's strutting with his pouting mouth, you know, Page going, "Oh God, I'm a guitar god," and the Edge and Jack White are just sat there in awe, you know, it's quite amazing.
I love the fact you made that guitar out of a plank of wood and a couple of nails. Remember, and he just said his lasting quote was something about, "Who says you need to buy a guitar?"
Well, you're in your little room and you're working on something good. But if it's really good, you're gonna need a bigger room. And when you're in the bigger room, you might not know what to do. You might have to think of how you got